After the 1968 invasion of Czechoslovakia by the Soviet Union, novelist Joseph Skvoretsky was left with few choices. If he stayed, he either had to recant his political views or go underground. He decided to leave and go to the West. The University of Toronto offered him a job, and he's been living and writing in Canada ever since. His best-known books are The Engineer of Human Souls, Dvorak in Love, and The Bass Saxophone. His new book, Sins for Father Knox, is a collection of detective stories that deliberately violate a popular set of rules for writing mysteries that were laid down in 1929 by Father Ronald Knox. Skvoretsky's love of crime fiction led him to this writing experiment.
When I was young, I was a sort of literary snob. I thought that crime fiction detective stories were not, worthy of reading. But when I was seriously ill for 4 months in an infectious ward in a hospital in Prague, and in those days they had no TV, no radios, no libraries, but books could be sent in. But since it was an infectious ward, the books had to stay there. So the only books my friends were willing to part with were crime stories. And so in the course of those 4 months, I must have read at least 200 detective novels, and I became an addict. And then I started writing them myself and studying the genre. And I came across this Decalogue by Father Knox. And it just occurred to me that it would be fun to write 10 stories that would violate the rules, so that the reader would be expected not only to guess or deduce who the murderer was, but also which rule was broken. It was just an idea I had.
When you started reading mysteries in Czechoslovakia, were they mostly American crime stories translated into Czech?
Well, in the 50s, mysteries were not permitted to be published in Czechoslovakia because they were thought to be a decadent Western capitalist genre. But many people had private libraries which were well stocked with American and British detective stories. So that most of the stories I read when I was in that hospital were old paperbacks of Chandler's and Hammett's and Agatha Christie's and all these people. So it was mostly American and British detective stories that we read.
Now, I think you first started writing detective novels under a pseudonym in the late 50s after your first novel, The Cowards, was banned.
Yeah, that's right, because I was not only my novel was banned, but I was banned from publishing for 5 years. And I had a very good friend who was a poet and a translator, so he lent me his name. And he's dead now, so that I can speak about it freely. And I wrote 3 long detective novels under his name. And I think that I am the only exiled writer who is published in Prague because they don't know that it's me. You know, one of those 3 detective novels was reissued about 3 years ago. And last year they even made a feature film from it. And I can prove that it is my novel because if you read the first letters of the first lines of each chapter, they give you my name, so I can prove it, you know.
Is it public in Czechoslovakia?
No. I just tell you, and I suppose it will come out sooner or later.
So do you expect that if the name ever is made public, that then those works will be banned?
Well, I'm sure they won't reissue them.
Uh-huh. Now, that first novel, The Cowards, which was published in 1958, was banned. It was set right at the end of World War II when the Nazis were retreating and the Soviets were moving in. Why was your novel banned?
Well, the official line was that it slandered the Red Army and that it slandered the revolution of 1945. Well, for one thing, there was no revolution in 1945. It was just the end of the war and an uprising in Prague in the last second of the war. And secondly, I simply described the Red Army as I saw it and as it really was. That is, I described soldiers who were dirty and who were singing, loud songs and stealing watches and who were chasing girls, as any soldiers of any army, including the American, because they had just been through battles, through the war. But in those days, the socialist realist mode was mandatory, and that called for, if you described the Red Army, you had to present Russian soldiers as almost saints, well washed and well behaved and playing the harmonica. And nothing else. So my portrait of the Red Army was found slanderous.
Several of your books have characters who are jazz musicians. Jazz is one of your passions, and you used to be a saxophone player as a teenager. Jazz was despised music under the Nazi occupation, and I'm not sure it did so well under the Soviets either. I think it's hard for a lot of people to understand how a non-representational art form like jazz music can be considered such a threat by a government.
Well, you know, both the Nazi and the communist governments are ideological governments. They had a very precisely defined ideology which divided the world into enemies and friends. And jazz is so very obviously an American music. It came from an America. And America was not a friend either of the Nazis or of the Soviets. So it was simply the music of the enemy, but they couldn't put it like that. So the Nazis simply said that jazz was Jewish and Negroid, you know, and the Jews and the Negroes were regarded as lower races, so whatever they did must have been unworthy of Aryan ears. Now, the Soviets, of course, could not base their theories on racism, so they based them on class discrimination, and they said that jazz was bourgeois music, which was simply a much bigger nonsense than what the Nazis said, because jazz certainly is a music created by the blacks, and at the time of the Nazi rule, there were many Jews active in jazz, from Benny Goodman to many others. But the real reason was that it came from America and that it became always very popular. You know, one of the very interesting phenomena of the 20th century is that popular music always comes from America, never from the Soviet Union. And of course, the explanation, I think, is easy, because popular music is spontaneous. But whatever starts, whenever something spontaneous starts in a totalitarian regime, it automatically becomes suspect, and the regime tries to suppress it.
In Czechoslovakia, one of your books was banned, and you were, you know, condemned by the government. Were you surprised when you came to Canada at how little impact so many books have after they're published?
Well, I wasn't surprised, because I find it quite natural. You know, in the communist countries and in the Nazi countries, when they existed, good literature that tried to tell the truth about life, was banned. It was forbidden fruit. And forbidden fruit is always something very special, and everybody wants to taste it. But in these countries like the States and Canada, nothing is really forbidden. Therefore, only people who have a real interest in literature read it. In those countries, everybody reads fiction, because it simply is forbidden fruit.
You and your wife run a publishing company that publishes the work of Czech writers. Do you publish mostly works that can't get published in Czechoslovakia?
Well, only books that can get published. And we publish books both by writers who live in exile and by writers who live at home but cannot publish their books there. So we simply specialize in banned books, you might say. And we also publish some American writers if they write about Czechoslovakia. So last year, for instance, we did a Czech translation of Philip Roth's short novel, The Prague Orgy. And this year we are going Arthur Miller's The Archbishop's Ceiling, which is set in a country which is not specified as Czechoslovakia, but every Czech reader will immediately recognize that it is Czechoslovakia. So that's what we do.
Can you get those books into Czechoslovakia?
Oh, yes, they are smuggled on a professional basis and also by many volunteers. You know, there is, because Czechoslovakia borders on West Germany, so there is a lively traffic across the border. And there are many tourists who are willing to take the books because they don't risk much if the book is found on them. And then also there is now the conditions in, for instance, Hungary and Poland are now much more liberal, so that books can be freely taken into Hungary. And to travel from Czechoslovakia to Hungary is easy. And the border controls are not as stiff as on the German border. So you can get books through Hungary, through Poland, or if you find tourists willing to do it, you can get them across the Czech-German border and in many other ways.
Thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.